kids or grandkids or anything. She goes, Charlie Brown didn't have kids. I go, but he had Snoopy. And then like 6 hours later, she texts me, ... Will Snoopy have Woodstock? Smiley face.
So, being guilted by your mother into getting a Christmas tree.
I know. I guess I need to get one. I need to get a Christmas tree. About as bad as I need to be a listener of this show, Game of Owns.
Game of Owns. It is that time of year.
Tried to find a way to marry it back into what we were talking about. It is that time of year, Eric.
Well, now that it's after Thanksgiving, you've got an entire month of Christmas music and Christmas festivities and chocolate and all of the other things that it is useful or encouraged to be doing by society in the wintertime. You know, this is actually the best part of the cold winter months because it's so festive.
It's true. I wanted to stop you for a second there. Mm-hmm. And ask you, why chocolate? Like, why, out of all the candies and of all the different sugar configurations, do you pick, like, is chocolate actually a holiday thing?
I think it is. Really? I think, well, I'm thinking specifically of the Christmas-colored Hershey Kisses.
Okay.
You know, the red and the green and the silver. That in particular screams Christmas. I guess it's because we always had them growing up. They were always around in the house. Not like we were encouraged to be fat or anything, but that was the one like indulgence that was like over the holidays we would get these holiday themed kisses. And really that's just growing up in a house where those were in a jar on the table at Christmas time. I guess it's just, it's always become one of those things I consistently associate with the holidays. But then there's also like melted like milk chocolate fountains experiences I've never had during Christmas time. But I think, you know, hot cocoa at the very least, is a winter
hot
thing.
Chocolate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and because I don't do coffee, the only time I really have a hot beverage at all, is hot cocoa in the winter months.
I do coffee. I do it. I take coffee. I take it. I do it. It's delicious. I love it with, other things put inside of it. I'm not really sure why we're talking about this stuff, but I mean, I haven't been on the show for a while. I kind of was on the show last week at one point, but I feel like that was so long ago still.
It feels like a dream. It almost feels like the last couple episodes have been a dream. That wasn't even me trying to transition, although I could. I'm not going to take the easy road here. I'm telling the truth. It feels like a dream. And it's nice to kind of just be in this stupor of relaxation and podcasting and going through the Game of Thrones book as we are, Clash of Kings, nearing the end. But we're not quite there, but we're almost quite there. And really just kind of a good time of year to be doing this.
Yeah, and we were reading this chapter today, this Theon chapter that Eric and I are taking care of. I was just thinking to myself how appropriate it was because, you know, we were talking about the holidays being here and they're on their way. We're now in the month of December and it's cold. Like, it's actually cold. There's some precipitation falling outside, I think, in snow form.
It's really cold.
I drove through a lot of snow in the mountains. I was in Colorado, and you know, I'm reading Theon being inside of Ned's bedchambers, and I'm thinking, yeah, you better close those blinds. It's cold outside, man. You know what I mean? Like, I felt the cold myself. I had to go get some extension cords and stuff out of my car to bring them into my office just now to set up for recording because I haven't, you know, how long has it been since I recorded here, right?
Yeah.
And I just kept thinking, Theon, close the blinds. Like, it actually is cold outside. Like, it's a shame. Like, I know he has all those furs, but I have a heated blanket, which I don't think he has, and I think that's a massive advantage of the modern world. Just massive heated advantage.
Yeah, let me. Yeah, I would completely agree with you. A heated blanket is, I'm pretty sure, the only thing that got me through living in the winter in New Zealand. In Wellington, when I lived there, had a heated blanket. I haven't used it since. I think I gave it up. But go, yeah, because it was it's configured for the foreign electric. So what are you going to do?
Please try it. Listen, I have never had a heated blanket in my life until like 2 weeks ago. It's over with. One of the best things I've ever seen or happened or touched.
Yeah, yeah. It is really, they are very, very comfortable. But curling up with a good book, you know, whether or not you've got an electric blanket is about the right thing to do this time of year. And you know, we here at Goor are just continuing to do that and continuing to bring you your analysis of these chapters, which, you know, honestly, the reason I think I'm not at all ashamed for delaying a little bit is because people don't really like Theon and people don't really care much for chapters that he's in. And so, you know, it's not like there's no great urgency for us to really dive in. Although I will say, the prognostication, or not prognostication, what am I trying to say? The visions that were delivered in this chapter are on par with the type of visions we've seen Dany succumb to Not just, you know, most recently in the House of the Undying, but anything that Bran or Jon Snow has gone through, Theon is now going through. And it's really very, you know, an interesting chapter all in.
We've got a slight look into that here at the top of the chapter. And I feel like let's just dive right into this frozen pond, shall we?
Frozen pond, yes.
From the top of the chapter, the sky was a gloom of cloud. The woods dead and frozen. Roots grabbed at Theon's feet as he ran, and bare branches lashed at his face, leaving thin stripes of blood across his cheeks. He crashed through, heedless, breathless, icicles flying to pieces before him. "Mercy," he sobbed. From behind came a shuddering howl that curdled his blood. "Mercy, mercy." When he glanced back over his shoulder, he saw them coming. Great wolves the size of horses with the heads of small children. Damn, that's freaky.
Is oh, that not mercy. Freakier than any yes. other creature? Like, you can imagine, like, a liger or... A liger is cheating. But you can imagine, like, a centaur or a minotaur and all these crazy half-animal, half-human things. But really, wolves with human faces... is like a new one because, I mean, for me, the thing that stands out about wolves is their snouts and their faces. Like, you wouldn't be able to tell a wolf from a coyote or a leopard or anything else, like, without its face. So it's just this four-legged human that's coming and biting at him and snarling.
That makes me think of Lost in Space. Do you remember when Gary Oldman was at the very end and he was in a spider's body? Spoiler
yes.
alert.
Yes.
That was some creepy shit.
That was actually, that remains to be one of like the best done like special effects that I like about like creature stuff. But yeah, I agree.
So it's a lot like that, I guess, in a way. Slightly uncomfortable.
Gary Oldman's chasing Theon and he's crying for mercy. Right. I would cry for mercy. Gary Oldman plays some twisted characters.
Blood dripped from their mouths, black as pitch, burning holes in the snow where it fell. Damn. Every stride brought them closer. Theon tried to run faster, but his legs would not obey. The trees all had faces, and they were laughing at him. Laughing, and the howl came again. He could smell the hot breath of the beast behind him, a stink of brimstone and corruption. That's a very strange stink, because the stone at the brim, they must have a certain type of odor. Anyway, they're dead. Dead, I saw them. Killed, he tried to shout. I saw their heads dipped in tar, but when he opened his mouth, only a moan emerged, and then something touched him, and then he whirled around shouting. So basically, Theon's now waking up from his terrible dream, Eric. Horrible, in fact, right?
It was a horrible dream. And just, again, about this imagery, though, seeing wolves with kids' faces, you're like, oh, that's creepy. Like, Theon must think it's, like, the craziest thing ever. But to us, it makes perfect sense as readers, because we've seen for several chapters, if not the whole book by now, that Bran and presumably Rickon have this ability to, you know, move their minds into these direwolves. It's actually a surprisingly literal literal visual interpretation of what's actually happening in the world. And the idea that Theon's guilt could be leading this dream sequence, could be leading, basically we find out that he's been having nightmares for a couple days now, ever since he returned from the mill. They're getting progressively worse. But it's this great, like, guilt that he doesn't even necessarily really acknowledge until the very end of this chapter. He's kind of been living with it. And he's just like, man, I can continue to distract myself from this. It's not right that I'm having these dreams. But he's not one to really give in to what nature is trying to tell him.
No, it's true. I feel like guilt is such a prevailing theme of this entire chapter. Because, I mean, especially starting out just like that, we know that the children do warg into wolves. And like you said, this is a very literal sort of interpretation of the kinds of things that we're seeing. And I feel like these dreams are getting even more and more literal and almost even more and more just almost not even dream sequency, just almost like, okay, well, that might happen. That could be fact. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now Theon's having these visions. And I think that they're more nightmarish driven than they would be as something that could be considered green sight. But still, I mean, there's definitely an element to this that has been seen in the rest of the dreams so far.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, even if we're looking at some of the other dreams that he has had, they center around these people that he's killed recently. You know, he has this dream where he's trying to put clothes on Bran and Rickon. I guess he had to dress the bodies in order to not parade them, but to show them to the rest of Winterfell. You know, he'd address them and they were like resisting him. And even though they're dead, like just their bodies were too still, like he couldn't easily lace them up or something. So he had a dream where he's lacing up Bran and Rickon's headless bodies. And then another dream he had with the woman, which was very interesting. The night before, it had been the Miller's wife. Theon had forgotten her name, but he remembered her body, soft pillowy breasts and stretch marks on her belly, the way she clawed his back when he fucked her. Last night in his dream, he had been in bed with her once again, but this time she had teeth above and below. And she tore out his throat even as she was gnawing off his manhood. It was madness. He had seen her die too. And in this case, Gelmar had cut her down with one blow of his axe as she cried to Theon for mercy. So this is clearly a guilt situation where he feels responsible for her death, even though it was Gelmar. But this whole gnawing off of his manhood, this whole, the idea that as he's pleasuring himself, he's losing that precious, oh so precious part of him. We know this actually happens. This is as clear as it gets to, you know, what he deserves. Or I think in some completely subconscious, because that's what dreams are anyway, in an unconscious, subconscious way, he is aware of the hot mess that he has gotten himself into. And I think a large part of this chapter too, what it revolves around is there's this big reveal at the end, right? That it wasn't actually Bran and Rickon, who were killed. But the whole chapter, he doesn't seem to even acknowledge that to himself. So you do go on believing that it's actual guilt for actually killing actual Rickon and Bran. And it's like, it's almost like the truth shall set you free. Cause like he really at the end, when it's like the last sentence reveals that that they're still alive, he should be free in some sense of feeling guilty about killing them, because ultimately, like, what does he have to be guilty for? Like, he killed the Miller's boys, sure, but it's not Bran and Rickon, and people can really rest easy, readers at least probably could, knowing that.
Yeah, I was expecting probably not to be told in this way, but it was really nice how George set it up in this chapter, because you're right. I mean, so much about what he's going through in this entire chapter revolves around these mistakes that he's made, and within these mistakes, sort of the people that he's wronged. So when you have a dream this insane, when George himself writes, it was madness inside of his dream. Like, he's describing it, there's teeth, it's crazy. It was madness, he says. It was madness. And I think that that's the truth of really Theon's entire situation here.
Oh yeah, and I can see why people have a problem with Theon as a character. Even though he's having these terrifying dreams, and it's been days since he started having them, he doesn't seem to, well, he doesn't act on it. He is given a great opportunity by Asha, his sister here, to leave Winterfell, and he doesn't take it. But also, like, he continues to make mistakes. He's far from being done from making mistakes, and not just in turning Asha down, but in appointing Reek, what he does to Reek. So without getting ahead of ourselves, basically, he does wake up from that first nightmare with the boys, with the wolves, with boys' faces, and Reek is there with him, which is weird because he actually asks not to be disturbed. So he's like, what the hell are you doing here? But Reek just took it upon himself to come into Theon's quarters and watch him sleep.
Yeah, he certainly got a little closer with Theon. And especially, I mean, what you were just talking about, what happens later on in this chapter, I was just like, damn. Like, you really didn't have to do much, Theon, to get in your tight, tight good graces. But apparently that doesn't take much. Needless to say, he is heading down to the Great Hall, as it were, if you could call it something like that, where Asha and her 20 men are waiting. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, 20 more men to come help. I mean, hell, Theon didn't even need that many people to take Winterfell. They could really use that. Lower your expectations, my friends, because when she leaves, she's only going to leave 10, and I'm pretty sure they're going to be the most unwashed and incapable soldiers that she can muster.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you could hate Asha for what she does in this chapter by only bringing, you know, 20 men and leaving only 10 of them. But ultimately she does want, you know, part of what she wants is for Theon to come with her. He, you know, word of Bran and Rickon's death has reached even her. Theon comments during this chapter that she even knows more than he does about how the locals are taking this murder, and she calls him out on a lot of the mistakes that he's made recently, number one being killing these boys. There's this great line, which was in the show, about, you know, which one gave you more trouble, the cripple or the babe. You know, she points out that really by killing them, it didn't further his honor. Nobody's going to respect him more for it, because what he did was kill a bunch of kids. And furthermore, it would have been a lot smarter to keep them alive as hostages. And she points that out. She says, some words to the effect of, you could have, you know, kept the North and one decisive swoop by just keeping these boys alive, but as hostages. And instead you've killed them. So come with me, brother. You should flee. And we should go back to my wooden piss pot, she calls it.
I mean, it's true. She's giving him such an easy out of this situation, because I think Theon is smart enough to know that the danger that his men are facing just inside of Winterfell now, you know, their day-to-day activities being so guarded, like it says in this chapter that he doesn't go to the privy without guards, without walking with other men carrying weapons while he goes and takes a leak. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
he has
people falling downstairs. Like, some of his men are
mysteriously.
Mysteriously. Do you think it's Reek?
You know, it's tough to say, because I have in good faith that there are some tough badasses that still roam the streets of Winterfell.
Right.
That,
like, are actual just biding their time. Yeah, just kind of like a resistance force, like a, you know, you don't screw with us kind of people.
Right, because I don't care how many mornings Theon Greyjoy wakes up in Ned Stark's bed. No one thinks that this is a permanent situation. No one believes that Theon has enough gall to really make this happen. You know what I mean? Like, he, Asha said it completely right. What you did was a nice trick. Like, that was really smart how you created a diversion and then took over Winterfell. But, you know, he didn't think further on at the situation. I think that everyone that is around this entire scenario understands that just as good as she does.
And Asha informs Theon when they talk that, you know, the Battle of Torrhen Square, it has been lost, essentially. I mean, it was a fantastic diversion. But Dagmar Clefjaw is making his way, you know, away from the area with survivors. They've lost the battle. And so all of the bannermen, everyone, around, all of your neighbors are your enemies, she says to him. You know, taking Winterfell was one thing. Keeping Winterfell is going to be something else entirely. And she knows that Theon cannot do it. And I think she even, you know, basically bids him a farewell, like, see you never ever again, goodbye brother, at the end of it, because she knows that essentially staying is inviting death. And I think he knows it, but he doesn't act on it. And, you know, as soon as she leaves, he's like, I should have gone with her, but he doesn't.
No, it's very good that in this moment he starts to understand the things that he's done wrong. I don't think that he feels any real regret for the things he's done that are wrong per se, but I think his largest trouble with what he's done is that he's made the wrong decision that would probably end up alienating him even further from his father. Like, he's already in a bad enough situation when he first gets the pike. You know what I mean? But now, after this has happened, and now that he may be facing some kind of death, in addition to losing the battles on the land, like, they definitely did not want to get into, you know, it just creates an even more tumultuous situation for Theon. But, I mean, at the same time, he did take Winterfell. So there is that.
Yeah, it's like this. I mean, he's this kid who, you know, has this glory that comes from this one event. Like, he got lucky, he got smart, you know. But it doesn't make him a great warrior, even somebody that people would respect. He's able to, you know, kind of come up with on the spot a reason for killing the boys. He says, "Well, I was avenging our brothers. You know, I guess the two brothers that were killed by the Starks previously." In his rebellion, Balon Greyjoy's rebellion. And that that even surprises Asha. She's like, oh.
It surprised me too. I was like, hey, nice last minute lie there, buddy.
Nice
it worked.
Like, we know he's totally pulling it out of his ass. But it works. She's just like she leaves him alone then. And he's like, dad would be happy to know that I was avenging them. And it works. She even says, like, I thought their ghost suddenly haunted him. So it's interesting, but I think she's being genuine. You know, she really kind of, she loves tormenting him. She loves it. And she totally gets off on it. And he continually feels every word that she utters that he has been shown up. And he has been, because he's just that pathetic, to be honest. It's so easy. Like you say about, you know, Reek joining the ranks and getting in the inner circle so quickly. It's really almost too easy. You have to have the gall to do it. you know, and I think we'll now analyze that in a minute, but with Asha, you know, wanting, you know, for him to come with her, and then the fact that he doesn't is just, well, that's a shame, because she can see that he's not going to last very much longer, that he's gotten in over his head. And it's the guilt of everything that he's done and the knowledge, at least subconsciously at this part, that he is in over his head, that's causing him to have such terrible sleep and is causing him to, you know, not be able to cope with the normal, otherwise, you know, plain goings on at Winterfell.
Yeah. And I think that Reek's ability to, I mean, let's just face facts here for a second. We know who Reek is. We know the kinds of abilities that Reek possesses and the kinds of things that he does. I mean, at this point, or at one point in the chapter, it's mentioned that he is the one who flayed off the skin of the small boys from the mill that were mistaken and dipped in tar and meant to lead people to think that they were Bran and Rickon. And I'm just thinking, okay, well, that's pretty clear. So maybe he's done a dirty job. Maybe this was good enough to be pals with Theon. But I don't think it is. I think it really comes down to the fact that Reek, in essence, is a noble-born person, and he was raised with good teachings, and he was raised with intelligence. And right now, he is just being a crafty, crafty son of a bitch,
yeah,
and working his way into Theon's circle. And he's just doing it so well. And, you know, especially after Asha leaves, and he basically comes up to Theon, and he's being like devil on the shoulder, like, oh, man, she left, huh? What do you think about that, Theon? Oh, that's rough, isn't it?
We already know that Theon, or that Reek, can read and write. This should have raised so many red flags, in addition to all the other ones that are raised every time Reek is in a scene. All of these red flags, like, he basically knows more than he should for the backstory that he was given, as, you know, as being this, I don't know what he was, the stable boy or prisoner of the Bastard of Bolton. He shouldn't know the things that he does, but Theon just uses it because he's so desperate for an advantage. He overlooks the fact that Reek shouldn't be able to do what he is doing, what he's capable of doing, and he ignores, you know, all the negative side effects and just says, oh yeah, you can help us. You know, you can go off and find me about 200 more men. You know, it's going to take some money. Okay, here you go. You know, here's some money. Just go off and do what you want. And Reek basically asks, he says, what? I know I'm from the North. I was born in the North. I know some men. I'd be able to help out. Really, he comes in as like this savior to Theon's plight, which is, I don't have enough men to continue to defend Winterfell or to get out alive. Reek says, okay, let me go off and I'll find some men for you. I mean, whether or not he will or what kind of men he's going to bring back, I don't know how it plays out quite in the books, but it's just so utterly shady and so conniving. And because we know who Reek is, we're able to really appreciate, I think, in the books, how he's just so slyly, you know, getting closer and closer to Theon's inner circle. I mean, he's Theon's most trusted advisor at this point. I think it's easy to say.
I know. It's kind of replaced the strange, mysterious first mate from the show. But it's tough to say. I can see what they did with those two characters now. And I think it's more interesting and more dynamic with this Reek character while Theon is at Winterfell, don't you? I just think it adds a level to it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they didn't want to cast somebody in the role for season two because it was going to be a bigger role in season three. But I think it would have been nice to see. At least in the show, he's got more men that are like around, and Winterfell is occupied by some of his men. And so I think that it almost looks better in the show that he has a little bit more of a chance in the show, even though there's still the scene with him, I think, trying to hack off the guy's head.
I do have that cutting from the book, not to use cutting as a jest here, but it goes to say he could not let the killings go unpunished. Farlan was as likely a suspect as any. So Theon sat in judgment and called him guilty and condemned him to death. Now, obviously, this is the Farlan is being blamed for the killings that haphazardly, air quotes, took place earlier. Like, oh, the mysterious drowning in the well, or oh, someone mysteriously fell down every stair and broke every part of his back. It continues, as he knelt to the block, the Killmaster said, "My Lord Eddard always did his own killings." Theon had to take the axe himself or look a weakling. His hands were sweating. So the shaft twisted in his grip as he swung, and the first blow landed between Farland's shoulders. It took three more cuts to hack through all that bone and muscle and sever the head from the body, and afterward he was sick, remembering all the times they'd sat over a cup of mead talking of hounds and hunting. "I had no choice," He wanted to scream at the corpse. The Ironborn can't keep secrets. They had to die, and someone had to take the blame for it. He only wished that he had killed him cleaner. Ned Stark had never needed more than a single blow to take a man's head. Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, Ned had ice. Ned did have ice. It was folded something like 100 million times.
Yeah, but three swings? Oh, I mean, listen, you've cut stuff. I don't know if you've ever chopped wood necessarily with a big axe, but I know that you've cut stuff and or have pretended to cut things. Think about using a sharpened, battle-ready axe on the back of someone's shoulders. That sucks, dude.
Yeah.
That
but
sucks.
It just, what sucks about it is that it takes it more than one blow, and it's not just because he's weak of strength. It makes him look weak as a character, that he can't do what this brilliant Ned Stark could do. You know, it's such a positional thing for him, not being like, it's, there's less honor to not being able to cleanly kill somebody. And Theon is just batting 1,000. This chapter is almost unbearable for somebody who likes the guy, because he continually just embarrasses himself. And it really is interesting to see that he had this moment where he could have pulled out and would have, you know, presumably gotten away safely, although I imagine he would have taken Reek with him, and Reek probably then would have infiltrated Deepwood Mott or wherever. And so he wouldn't have been safe from Reek necessarily, if Reek is a threat, but he would have been safe from everybody who's now turning their eye back on Winterfell. Well, so Theon has a really bad way of dealing with, actually, he doesn't deal with all of his emotions. He sends Asha away. She leaves, I think it's from the same bridge that Bran and Rickon escaped from and all this stuff. But he tries to drown out all of his thoughts, all of his feelings. You know, and I mean, we have ways of dealing with this. Alcohol is a big one. Theon, he just grabs a girl and injures her with lots and lots of sex, trying to forget her.
There's really no way to sugarcoat it. Essentially, Theon rapes a girl. I mean, he brings a girl into his bedchambers, and at one point, what does it say? It says he sent for Kyra, kicked the door shut, climbed on top of her, and fucked the wench with a fury he'd never known was in him. By the time he is finished, she was sobbing, her neck and breast covered with bruises and bite marks. Theon shoved her from the bed and threw a blanket. Get out. Hey, at least he threw her a blanket, though, right?
Well, by that joke, you could also say, well, she got to see Ned Stark's bedchambers. Hey.
Oh, everything is terrible.
Everything is bad about this situation. I think Zach and I both agree it's a horrible thing.
Yeah. I didn't know that he hooked up with the Mills wife either. And so that happened. And it's just like, when you say hooked up, that's like, when I was watching the show, I didn't necessarily get the whole Theon decides to do everything, so let's take off his manhood, and that's the most, like, that's his best part of his body, because I just feel like in the show, he hooked up with about as many people as other people that hook up with people in the show,
if
that makes any sense. Yeah. But here in the book, it's clear, like, the kind of person that does this, that can't just, okay, let's sack the mill and kill these two kids, oh, I have to sleep with the wife. They can't just go to sleep at night. Oh, I'm so pissed off at everything. Stick this wench in here and we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, he's behaving as maybe the king would be, except the king probably wouldn't live in a state as this, where he's sieging a town that's not his, and the people he's inviting up aren't his people, if that makes any sense, right?
He's adolescent. He's selfish. He's crude. He's, you know, obviously very destructive of everything around him. And he needs to be stopped.
Interesting, though, when you read it, I'm just going to read the last paragraph of the chapter. I know we've read a lot, but so much of this needs to be just read rather than spoken to you guys. It says, Theon gazed at them silently. This is talking about the heads that were up on the spikes outside. Theon gazed at them silently while the wind tugged on his cloak with small ghostly hands. The Miller's boys had been of age with Bran and Rickon, alike in size and coloring, and once Reek had flayed the skin from their faces and dipped their heads in tar, it was easy to see familiar features in those misshapen lumps of rotting flesh. People were such fools. If we'd said there were ram's heads, they would have seen horns.
Mm.
Mm. So I think what we can take away from this is that, just like we said earlier on in the chapter, to whatever extent Theon is allowed to feel this inside of his own head, I think he's feeling a little bit of remorse, but not quite remorse for what he's done, like I said before, but more of just remorse for the entire situation and what he's let himself into.
Yeah, for sure. Hell, I think it would be a pretty fun drinking game, because we got Ned. Ned was mentioned again in this chapter. Of course, they're at Winterfell, so it's like, well, who's the biggest guy in Winterfell? It's Ned. Recently departed, dear Ned. A fun idea for a drinking game would be to drink every time Ned gets mentioned after his death. But but depending on what number book you're on, that's how many drinks you have to take. So in book two, every time Ned is mentioned, you take two shots. But I have a feeling that these Ned references about honor, about cutting people's head off with one blow, are not going to go away. I have a feeling that Ned and actually Theon sees Ned in his dream towards the end of the chapter as well. Headless, of course. Very interesting prophetic dream, but we just get so many of them. It's really like, how often do you want to repeat the fact that the people who are
everyone dead was dead? They were eating lunch, let's just say, right? They were just dead eating lunch together.
There's a song called Dead Man's Party by Oingo Boingo. And it's what I think of when I was reading this, or what I thought of when I was reading this thing. But I mean, that's Theon for you. And you know, as we conclude this chapter, I really hesitate to ask you, Zach, what was your own?
It's tough, you know, because Asha was in this chapter, and she does a damn good job of saying stuff out loud. And I just wanted to highlight one thing that she said, and it was directed toward Theon's crown, but also another thing that wasn't necessarily an Asha own. I'm going to break one of your rules. But first to Asha, it says, "You ought to know that's the ugliest crown I've ever laid eyes on. Did you make it yourself?" he basically did. Someone just made it randomly for him.
Can you imagine like a macaroni crown? Like, yeah. It's just like glued, Elmer's glue and macaroni.
Just use a Burger King crown. They look fine. All right. Yeah. They look fine.
Yeah.
And this next one goes to actually Theon himself. I think that he did a great job. This was an example of an own where someone decides to insult a physical location. He said, "Bugger Deepwood, it's a wooden piss pot on a hill. Winterfell is the heart of the land, but how am I to hold it without a garrison?" Very true.
Well, I'm going to break my own rule in this chapter too. And
what?
Give, yes.
This is the first time.
Then I can't do it. Is it really the first time I've broken
it? Really
my own
is, rule? But listen, if it's, I mean, listen. It's your bullshit stupid rule, okay? But if you want to break it,
I feel like Theon's breaking all of his rules. Well, look, then okay, I'm going to reverse it. I'm going to make it so it's not an own for Theon.
Okay.
My own is going to Master Luwin or Meister Luwin. He asks that the children's bodies be deposited in the crypts the way that it is right, you know, to do with Stark bodies. And right. Theon says, "Hell no." He's tired of these bodies. He says, "Screw tradition." He ends up burning these bodies of the Miller's sons. That would have been my own if I were in the mood for giving Theon an own, but I'm going to give it to Meister Luwin for simply asking, you know, trying to observe the traditions that they hold dear. You know, it's a shame Theon didn't get it. But maybe Theon did it because he knew they weren't really the real bodies, you know? So I think that, you just got to give it to Meister Luwin for continuing to look out to be some sort of shepherd of tradition there at Winterfell, even when it's in such disarray from what Theon has done.
Yeah, and I thought in that moment that it was Theon, like, being honorable, you know, that's what a freaking stretch to make. But it's Theon, like, he grew up in this place, and he knows that that is the tomb for the Starks and for their entire bloodline. And so maybe he was thinking, no, they don't need to be buried there. You know, they're not even Starks, so what's the point? But at the same time, it's probably because they bear no physical resemblance to the boys at all. And probably
he's just tired of hearing these crypts. They creep him out. They creep everybody out.
They do.
But he's just tired of these creepy things that are reaching out to him in the darkness. He's sick of it. That concludes our Theon chapter.
Hey, guys, look, we just finished talking about our owns. What a perfect time to transition into a segment where we don't quite talk about your owns, and it's not quite a segment, but it is as follows.
Yes. We got some comments here on Twitter that I like to read. The first from Crystal Murphy. She says, "I love your podcasts. I just got into them recently. They make drives and the off season tolerable. Keep making me laugh and think."
I like that. Laugh and think.
Laugh,
you know,
and
what I mean?
Think. Like, haha, I'm thinking while I'm laughing. Like, yeah. Pondering while smiling. We have some support from Atomics IGN. Hurry back. We had a little bit of a Thanksgiving break there, and it's nice to be wanted to be back. And let me assure you, Atomics IGN, we are in fact back.
Oh, we're back.
We are back.
I see a tweet from Ida. "Where is the new episode of At Game of Owns?" It was there only a few hours after you tweeted that, Ida.
Yes.
See how that works? Answering your prayers and or tweets on a daily basis.
As we do. Speaking of prayers, Atheist Burrows. I can't make this up, okay? At Atheist PR Girl who's apparently the PR girl for atheists everywhere, says, yep. Game of Owns, oh my god, Zach made a bananas in pajamas reference. I'm satisfied now.
Oh, it took that long, but finally you're satisfied.
You know satisfied.
How many hours I've been slumped over computer editing this shit, and now you're satisfied.
What did you say that was bananas in pajamas?
We were singing it to each other, I think. And I was bananas in pajamas. Something else was mentioned, and I was like, oh, but what about these things? They're fruit and footwear. That's good.
Well, atheist. And by the way, we got a comment from Ryan McAllister saying, no wasted wine here. So
good to
that's
know.
Always good for holiday experiences. But, you know, to atheist, if you really truly are satisfied with our podcast, we would ask that you would head over to iTunes and give us a good old rating if you can. Subscribe to us, obviously, on iTunes if you want our shows automatically sent to you via your iTunes software, but also you can give us a review and give us, you know, a rating and a review to help others find and click on our podcast. It's just something we ask of our listeners, and you know, you can read the reviews that are already there. People have been very generous, partly because we threatened to attack them with all sorts of crazy galloping camels and other stuff. You know,
the
if
most
they don't
dangerous kind of camel,
you know, in the week of or in the month of December,
in the
now,
week of December, guys,
in the week of the first week of December, the nothing less than 5 stars is acceptable. If Micah were here, he would tell you to your face. But I'm telling you instead, and just again, atheists, we're glad that you're glad that you're satisfied.
I'm glad that you're glad that she's satisfied.
It's true. You know? It's there was gladness all around.
Gladware.
Gladware. In fact. But
here's an email. Okay, I'll just go right into it. I'll just literally going to dive directly into this email. Hey guys and gal, I have to start off by admitting that on my list. Excuse me, let me try that again. I have to start off by admitting that on my first read-through of A Clash of Kings, I fully believed that George had killed Bran and Rickon. Last we hear about them, the sketchy Reek character is telling Theon he knows where they are. Then there isn't another Bran chapter until the end of the book. Everyone thinks they are dead. On the other hand, I don't think any of our Unsullied friends believed for a second that Bran and Rickon were dead, and if they did, it was only until the end of the episode. I'm also surprised how long it took them in the TV show to tell Rob and Catelyn that the boys were killed, because this is a huge part of her motivation in her decision to free Jaime. Completely agree. Amazing point. Even after they hear the news on the show, Rob is kind of optimistic that they might be alive, which I found strange. Agree. All this to say, this was one of George's best hoodwinks of the series, and it's a shame it really did translate. It's a shame it really didn't translate onto the screen with the same effect. Tim Mulligan. Thank you for your email, Tim. I agree.
You know, and I wonder if it's just less credit to Theon for Rob not believing he could really have killed the boys as he said he would. Maybe it's because it's like the bro thing where it's like, he totally wouldn't have done that, but he would say he would. Or did.
I think it's more credit to Theon to think that maybe Theon wouldn't do that to his little brother. You know what I mean?
Really depends. Yeah. Depends on if you're meant to like or hate Theon. But I agree, in the show, it wasn't a mystery at all. We talked about that before, namely even during the episode. But in the books, hey, I mean, it's good to know that you were hoodwinked, as you say. And it's just, this must have been such a relief then at the end of this Theon chapter to be like, oh, okay, they could be still alive. You know, interestingly, that reminds me, like, what does Theon think is going to happen? It's another reason why he should have gone with Asha, because eventually Bran and Rickon are going to reappear into the picture. Like, does he think he's driven them off, like, really? Like, forever? Because they belong in the north, and they have so many bannermen. He hasn't sacked any nearby cities. Like, they could literally have gone anywhere, even to the Boltons, and been like, hey, we're alive.
Don't flash.
Yeah, why don't you go help us, you know, kill or get back at Theon? So, and they would have obligated to, because they're bannermen. So I think Theon should have taken that out. We're about to see the downfall of a very mistake-ridden boy in Theon, and we're about to see it all go downhill. But this was kind of calm before the storm. It's one of those great chapters that has a lot of imagery, and we're glad that you were relieved at the end of this, Mr. Tim M. But if you want to send us an email, just like Tim did, you can email us at contact@gameofowns.com. That is our email address. If you wanted to tweet at us, you can find us twitter.com/GameOfOwns. And of course, we're on Facebook as well. Facebook.com/GameOfOwns. If you're thinking of us, or you want to check out some of the latest memes and funny things that are happening in the world of Game of Thrones, go scrawl upon our wall or view our wall on Facebook.
It's true. And thank you so much again, Tim, for your email. We encourage you guys all to get in touch with us in the show, because that does nothing but light a fire underneath our community and cook it and enrich it like a nice, beautiful, delicious stew that deserves to be eaten. I'm Zach Lloyd.
I'm Eric Skull.
And that is your furnace.
It's creepy. It's creepy.
It is.
It's going to give me some nightmares.
Sounds like just air is coming. What does it look like?
It's metacular. Metal. It's metal-ish. Metaline.
Metaline.
You know, the smallest of them all was Metaline. Two straight houses and two little girls and two. I'm missing opening lines of Madeline. There we go. Okay, here we go. This is how the Madeline books. In an old house in Paris that was covered with vines lived 12 little girls in two straight lines. In two straight lines, they broke their bread and brushed their teeth and went to bed. They left the house at 9:30 in two straight lines in rain or shine. The smallest one was Madeline.
Fine.